Hello.
Hello, it's Kiki here.
And Alex.
We're traveling down under for a musical about music itself.
Grace Taylor and Tim Gilvin join us to talk about their new show, Music and Freedom.
How they adapted a novel which is not in print in the UK.
And why writing a musical for an older actor has been an exciting challenge.
Welcome to
Making a Musical, the future of British musical theatre. Kiki, are you ready to board a plane?
Yeah, where are we going?
We're going to the other side of the world for this story.
Oh.
Today on the podcast, we've got Grace Taylor, who is book, lyrics and director of this show, and Tim Gilvin, who's lyrics and composer. And the show is called Music and Freedom, based on an Australian book. Mm-hmm. Tell us, what is Music and Freedom and what can we expect from the musical?
Music and Freedom is the story of an older protagonist who is reborn and revives herself and her career and her artistic life with the help of her next door neighbor, who is a pianist. And our older protagonist is also a pianist, and they form a bond with classical music and, yeah, revive each other.
It's very wholesome.
It's good. So it's an adaptation of a novel by Zoe Morrison, and the novel is a fantastic novel. It's only published in Australia at the minute. So obviously when we do our world tour, we'll get it published worldwide. Mm-hmm. But it's a fantastic read. But it tells the story of our protagonist, Alice, and she moves from Australia to the UK when she's seven. So it's very much a sort of, cross-global, what would you say? Totally
intercontinental.
Intercontinental.
Ooh, yeah.
Story. So Australian author, Grace is an Australian collaborator of mine. I'm English. And in the story, we've got both locations as well. And at the end of the end, don't want to spoil it, but at the end of the show, Alice returns home and sort of reconnects with her roots in Australia, in the bush.
So you mentioned this book has only been published in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
How then did you come across it originally?
That was me. The book was recommended to me when I went home. I think it might have been late 2019, early 2020. And when I read it, the Zoe Morrison, who's the author of the novel, is a concert pianist herself, as well as an anthropologist and novel writer. She's pretty incredible. And the novel has music all the way through it. It's one of these novels that you can hear as well as see when you're reading it.
Mm.
And so when Tim and I wanted to collaborate on something and wanted to adapt something, this felt like a really obvious choice because of just how much music is woven through the narrative, really.
From the tracks that we're going to hear, it's so beautiful, that sense of lyricism and the, I guess that kind of melody of classical music really, really comes through. Obviously, classical music is a big part of the book. How did you decide how that was going to play a part in the music world of the show?
Yeah, well, that was one of the things that drew me to it, really, is it was an opportunity to do something really different. So I've written in other styles and idioms before, sort of pop, rock, more traditional MT. But I have a bit of a background in classical. I'm a long way from being a concert pianist myself. I couldn't play this score. Ha ha ha. But but it's a challenge. It's a challenge to inhabit that idiom and to write in classical style. But also, there's so much named classical music in the book. There's a lot of Rachmaninoff, but there's also references to Beethoven and Debussy and Ravel. And so there's an opportunity to interpolate those out of copyright classical works into the score. So rather than if it were a play, you would just hear a bit of an extract from those classical pieces. But in this musical adaptation, we've been able to play with them and interpolate them. It's been a lot of fun. Hopefully, audiences get to hear it at some point, but the score is all marked up with this is a little Beethoven quote and this is a little.
So there's Easter eggs for us to listen
Easter
to.
Eggs, yeah, to the classical music aficionado.
And so the protagonist's journey, her whole history and her whole life is interwoven with the piano, basically. It's her whole life. She is moved from rural New South Wales in Australia to far north
Whitby. Grace is not from the UK.
That's okay. I understand.
I'm foreign. I'm so sorry.
Whitby.
At 7 years old, she's packed off to the other side of the world in like the 40s and 50s, you know, a really long way to go for such a small child. And because her mother believes that she could succeed as a concert pianist on the other side of the world. And so that's what her whole life is about. And so when we meet her in her later part of her life, having had to give up the piano, her memories are so interwoven with these classical pieces. It's just so intrinsic to Alice's life.
Yeah. So how did you guys first meet and become collaborators?
Yeah. I don't know how we first met. Probably through Signal, which was a series of concerts that Adam Lentzen put on throughout the latter part of the pre-pandemic era.
the before times.
The before times.
That does feel like another era.
In a beautiful venue that's now closed, obviously. But
obviously.
So Grace was helping there. We sort of probably met to sort of say hello to and to know. And then we were looking for a director for Stay Awake, Jake, one of my shows. And it's a one-man musical set in a car. 55 minutes long, it's cracking. And Grace was recommended by our producer at the time to come on board. So we got to know each other, but actually getting that on its feet was as with so many new musicals, it was a real journey of several years. And then we eventually managed to do it in a sort of concert live stream, semi-staged version from Southwark Playhouse with Ahmed Hamad in 2020.
Literally the day we closed for Christmas. You know that time when he was like, you've got till midnight to get where you want to go for Christmas? That was that day.
When it was the day they invented a new tier for London. Yeah. Do you remember?
Oh my goodness.
And everyone's like, I'm not going to be able to get home. I'm not going to, you know, it was one of the most surreal points. But anyway,
we
made some beautiful art in the middle of that. And then afterwards, Grace was like, let's keep collaborating. Let's find a project that we can work together on. I was like, hell yeah. And we wanted to adapt something. I've never adapted anything properly before. And they say it's the secret to a good musical, don't they? Is adaptation, rather than trying to write your own story. And actually it has been good because I'm really proud of the book, the plot. You know, the plot is always the hardest thing. The story structure is always the hardest thing. And when it's already there and it's already good, it does make it a lot easier.
Yeah.
And just again, let's put it on a stage so we can prove that to
people. Yeah, I think it kind of got us through the first part of 21, which was really hard, just meant that we were ticking over a collaboration, we were thinking about something. And then we actually wrote Pulling Away, right? Like the first thing that was written,
the first
was
thing we wrote,
Pulling Away, which we then used to talk to Zoe about getting the rights and all of that kind of stuff. So that was like the first thing that we did, but we'd been kind of mulling it over for, I mean, months by that point. And it was just the right thing that kind of brought us together. I mean, you know, the Oxford Australia connection and then also classical music and women's stories, and it just is the thing that kind of is our shared language we can come together on.
So how did that approach work? Take us through step by step with Zoe in order to get the rights.
Oh, we sent her an email.
Yeah.
And she is just an incredible human being, I think. So talented and so intelligent. She had not thought of her novel as being a musical.
No, as you can imagine, right? Right. It's a very literary novel. It's a very beautiful novel, it's erudite, I would say. Mm. And people think of musicals, I don't know what it's like in Australia, but in this country as well, people who don't engage with musicals always think of musicals as being a low art form. And I think she was worried when we said we wanted to be a musical that it was 42nd Street version of Music and Freedom, which is obviously not, as you'll hear from the demos.
This is the no tap dancing is what I'm hearing.
Right.
Well, I tried.
no tap dancing. No kick lines in this one.
Yeah.
So we had to just gently convince her that this would be a sort of story-led and share more of a sort of common language with plays than it does with Singing in the Rain.
Probably. Yeah. And we wanted to go in with some material so that she could understand really the musical language. She's a pianist, and it was really important to like show her that we were coming at it from the same angle as she was. And so we
Can't remember if we sent one demo or two.
It was just one, I think. Just pulling away.
And then a conversation.
Yeah.
I think we had a Zoom, I believe. And then she was happy to give us the shopping rights.
We paid $1 Australian.
And I presume that's because you create an agreement and, you know, the exchange of money validates an agreement.
Yes. And also we had a really lovely dialogue with Zoe, and we talked about, you know, how long it takes to develop a musical, that the fact that it won't be on stage for years and all of those things. And she was really understanding and was excited to hear what we would come up with.
Yeah. So there is an expiration on that agreement. We do need a venue and a producer, please. in order to get to the next stage, and then there'll be another agreement at that point. But yeah, that's where we're at with the rights for the novel. We just had a lovely time writing it. Desperate to share it with the world now, I guess.
So you've mentioned the first song you've written for this piece now called Pulling Away, which is the first song we're going to listen to on the podcast. Should we get a little bit of context as to where it sits within the show?
Yeah, so the frame of the story, the bulk of the story is telling Alice's story through her rebirth and her regrowth when she's in her twilight years, living alone in Oxford after the death of her husband. But we flash back in time quite a lot throughout the show in order to gradually get to understand a bit more about how she's ended up at this point. And this is one of those flashbacks. So it's the 1950s at this point in this flashback, and she's recently become married to a man who she believed to be a good man but turned out to be a horrible, controlling monster. And in the 1950s, and later, and probably still to this day, that meant that she became totally entrapped in this relationship. She didn't have any agency. She didn't have any power to leave. But one day she gathers what she can, money-wise, and goes down to Oxford Station. But she doesn't really have a clear idea of how she's going to continue her journey once she gets to London. And so she can't quite pick up her feet to get on the train and leave the relationship. So she spends the whole day sat on the platform at Oxford Station, and at the end of the day, she goes home.
Can I help you with anything? And then I am left alone, as though everyone here is used to that sort of thing. I pay tuppence for a cup of tea, a penny to use the lavatory, and the coins jangle in my coat pocket as I try to work out what to do. The 9:39 pulls into the station. The benches thin out as the passengers stand. I want to join them, squeeze into that carriage, but instead I just sit where I am. And the train pulls in and pulls away. Rubbing the floor and the windowsill, up and down and repeat, just like practicing skates. Wiping a cloth in the crack between the wall and the floor, leaving the cloth where it is, and walking out the front door. And the 3:59 pulls into the station. November twilight and feet going numb. I could hop aboard and unfold the evening edition, but instead I just sit where I am. And the train pulls in and pulls away. Another time, there could be another couple like this. She'd sit in the chair, he'd be at the door with two cups of tea, one for her, one for him. He would get down on his knees, lay his head in her lap, start to weep and beg her to play. It would be And the 8:21 pulls into the station. I pick up my feet and walk back to that man. Back to dinners and dishcloths and tempers, resigned to remain where I am. And the train pulls in. Pulls away, pulling away.
I think that song is absolutely beautiful. I remember watching it at the Beam conference this year and being like, wow, what is this? I think it's also really exciting to see a song that's specifically written for an older performer. Take us back to the beginning of your writing partnership. Nitty gritty, what does it actually look like to write between the two of you? Because Grace, I believe you're predominantly a director. That's how I know you. Yes. You've done many projects here at the Other Palace with that mantle. How has it been stepping into, you know, that writer role? And then also, how has it been writing for, you know, a woman of an older age?
So firstly, I did do a creative writing degree.
Well,
I know.
What?
I know. Back in Melbourne. So I've always kind of had structure and that kind of, that element of writing in my head all the time. I work on a lot of new works and I work with a lot of writers. And so I kind of get really excited about good structure and good book writing and good scripts. And I think that that's where it came from. It just kind of was a feeling for me that I could do it. It has been petrifying and also hilarious and fun and wonderful. But it's really, I think I hadn't realized just quite how exposing it is for an author, a writer, to put their work out there. And when I did decide I wanted to give it a go, it was with someone that I knew who's amazing, and also that we could trust each other to, like, you know, if it wasn't working, I trusted Tim would tell me without being mean and horrible about it, but also not holding back.
Yeah. Although sometimes mean and horrible is the only... No, I'm joking. I think it was really interesting for you, wasn't it? Because I think if I remember rightly, the planning, the plotting, we did first.
Yeah.
We did it all. And we
like
did it to quite a level of detail as well. We went over it quite a few times before we started writing anything.
So are we talking post-its on the wall, spreadsheets?
Grace's iPad in the pub.
Yep. Great. Yeah.
Solid Google Doc.
Google Doc. But then you had this cool pen, didn't you, on your iPad? You were annotating, and then the scribbles were turning into serif fonts.
It was modern world.
Good notes.
But yeah, so it was just a lot of a lot of bullet points and scribbles and that sort of thing. But yeah, trying to do the whole good practice Robert McKee story thing of plotting before you start writing, although we didn't plot for years and years. And then we got to writing it, and if I remember rightly, there's that saying, I think it's from Pixar, fail fast and fail early, right? Which is just a great mantra. You just got to not judge what you're writing as you write it. And that was hard for you because that's your job is to judge writing when you're dramaturging new musicals. So yeah, I remember just having to say to you like, oh, just we'll do that for now.
Yeah.
Like, that can be our for now, and then we can change it and revise it. Because that's composition, it's revision and revision and revision.
And it's one of those things where, like, I knew that. In my heart, I knew that. It's just very...
cerebrally.
Yeah, it's just quite exposing. And we did a reading of the first draft of the show at the end of last year. Just, you know, little thing in a room with some mates kind of vibe. And it was... very freaky, very scary. But it's the first time I've done anything like that, so whereas I think, you know, it's just a different skill to what I'm used to doing, and I'm really excited to continue to do that.
I was it's a new thing that I do for projects that you're writing on under your own steam, so writing this on spec. In other words, it's not a commission, we're not getting paid, and there's no real deadline. Is create a deadline, which is you invite some pals to a room, which is exposing, and it is like a bit like, and you know, we'd been meaning to write this show over the course of 6 or 7 or 8 months. We wrote it, most of it, in about 2 or 3 weeks before this.
And what I would argue is my second favorite song after Pulling Away, Tim wrote the night before that reading.
Yeah.
A Piano Is, by the way, which is...
Oh, that one.
Yeah, you didn't write that the night before?
I don't remember.
You turned up and you were like, I've got it. I've got the thing got that it. Goes in that little spot.
Yeah.
And you played it to me as part of this reading. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
Overnight? Who are you?
Yeah. It's when you write intensively like that, it's very good because you get a sense, you get to hold the whole thing in your head. And this is a show about, as I say, it's very literary, it's sort of poetic, it's very lyrical. There is a world in which it could have been 12 ballads, and I was quite keen to get some of that energy. And especially when you say classical as well, people think soothing and spa music, but there's so much of classical music which is spiky and full of humour and energy and
drama.
Drama
as well.
Exactly, yeah. And
I love the word spiky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because these were, you know, these classical composers, they weren't, you know, stuffy old portraits of people. They were, you know, real people living their lives. And anyway, so we tried to get some of that energy into that song that we're talking about, which you'll hear later on.
Yeah.
A Piano Is, yeah.
Yeah, and it had to fill, there was quite a lot of plot that needed to be kind of covered in that moment. It was a lot about her past colliding with her future and her present and coming to grips with the idea of her role as a pianist and what the piano felt like to her. And this song was written overnight. I was just...
So you've talked about the importance of deadlines in shaping how you're writing, and you've obviously had those two big deadline moments. So you're sharing your reading in front of mates and then Beam. What did you learn at each step? How has the show kind of evolved?
The deadline to read it through, you learn the most, really, because when you hear some, when I play something for the first time to an audience, I hear it like it's new. Whereas the day before you've been playing it and you're like, well, I don't know, you've heard it 5, 10, 20 times now and like it doesn't make any sense. So you learn so much from that and from people's reactions, and we have loads of notes from that, which we need to implicate into the script. But loads of structural notes, like, oh, there's a dip there, there's a thing there. Yeah. Beam, it's a totally different thing, I would say. You're trying to find the next steps for the show, and you actually end up being your own producer when you're working under your own steam like this. When you're writing on spec, you're sort of thinking about how to sell it, which is fine. It's something you have to think about. But so it's a totally different thing. You don't learn as much about the structure and the dramaturgy and all of that.
But what we did learn, and I think that was really interesting, is what it sounds like when it's sung by somebody who is, you know, it's a different voice type, it's a different, yeah. And how the ebbs and the flows of the songs actually affect people. So that was really interesting. And also, like, we got a little bit of a snapshot of what it might look like when it's being performed. That's so true. There was that was really exciting because we hadn't heard it sung by anyone except for Tim.
We got people crying, didn't we?
We did.
That was the main comment after Beam. It was like, oh, you got me. It's like, yes. That's what we want.
One of the things that really captured me about the show is this is a role for an older actress.
Yeah.
And that is actually incredibly rare. I mean, I'm just trying to think on the spot here. I'm thinking about, like, Grandma from Billy Elliot.
I mean, Grey Gardens,
yeah.
Sheila Hancock did that.
Mame, yeah. So there's Sister Act. But that presumably has been both an opportunity and a challenge.
Yes. Yeah. I think, so the biggest thing around that is that there are two elements of this show and the novel that we really wanted to hone in on. So firstly was our older protagonist. It's so rare to see somebody on stage who isn't, who is of that age demographic, who isn't somebody's mother or isn't a faded star. And it's really, you know, it's a lot of faded stars on there, on the stage. So we just really wanted to have somebody who had her own agency, made decisions and excelled under her own steam. And then the second part of it was that there were the two women characters. So the younger woman who's the neighbor and Alice, our protagonist, who come together over their love of Rachmaninoff, really. Mm. And that was exciting, is that that this younger woman was able to help Alice and Alice was able to help our younger woman.
Yeah. And then practically it's a really cool thing. People are excited when they hear about that. But at this stage, at the grassroots stage, it's a bit of a challenge as well, as you say. So, but we were lucky to have Julie Legrand perform for us at Beam. We've got Susie McKenna has recorded some demos for us, which you're hearing today, both fab actresses. But, you know, when you're doing a show with protagonists who are in their 20s, we found that we've had to do a bit more legwork this time. Usually you can get some mates around to sing it and there's a lot of goodwill, which is amazing from the community. But we just have to look a bit further afield for this.
And
I think in the end, it's going to be amazing.
And we have overwhelmingly found that people are really positive about Alice as a character. And we have got a lot of goodwill from the performers who have come and helped us out. It's fantastic. And then, you know, people have often all around Beam, and then other times we've talked about the show, people have commented on just how great it is to see someone of that age group.
I think there is a space for it where it'll be really powerful and impactful. It's just finding what that is the next step on our journey. Yeah.
Well, it sounds really exciting. And are we allowed to talk about, you know, the moment for this character?
Because, yes.
I mean, I think what you're talking about, what I always look for a lot is how women are represented. And I think you're right. This is a really exciting opportunity to see an older performer showcased in a show where they can sing 12 songs beautifully. Well, maybe not all 12.
Yeah.
But then also perhaps destroy things on stage.
Oh yeah.
The main show should have led with that.
So this is a story of somebody who is able to shake off the specter of abuse that has haunted her for 30 years. That's really Alice's journey, and she does this with the help of Emily, her neighbor, and all of that. And part of her enslavement, part of the thing that has locked her in her house for all of those years, is this amazing Steinway piano that her husband buys her the week before they get married.
Mm. Yeah, so so she's unsure, and then he says, no, I've bought you this piano, come and marry me, and how bad can it be? And then as soon as they're married, she finds out the, you know, demon that he really is. But her act of triumph, her act of actually throwing this all off, is to grab the axe and to smash up the grand piano.
Yeah.
Live on stage.
Oh, I love it.
Which is great. It's in the novel. It's such a powerful moment. We're like, that's hard to stage. But Grace has got a plan. She won't tell you what it is.
I love it.
She won't tell you what it is.
I mean, I'd hope you do, because that is a moment. You know?
And also, it's something that we're anticipating for quite a long time in the show, which I'm really excited about. Is she going to do it?
Chekhov's axe in scene one. We do have it in scene one, don't we?
Yeah, we have prologue. You know, stage directions around the axe and its movement around the stage. And the thing about, you know, being a director and then a writer is so much of what is written is visual. And in her act of triumph, smashes the Steinway and packs up her bags and goes to Australia.
And it is spoiler, cool, isn't it? It is cool. Like having an older woman being able to express anger and fury and growth and all of that stuff. Like I'm excited to see that on stage. And hopefully other people.
Well, and there's nothing as wonderfully infuriating as your friend being like, you have to see this show. There's this moment in act two, and I'm not going to tell you what it is because I don't want to spoil it, but it's incredible.
You'll be like, well, I listened to the podcast. And then...
There's been a lot of build up. So I really hope that we can, we'll definitely do it. It's such a pivotal moment, and
We've got to do it. Got to stage it.
Yeah, it'll be on
there. Keys flying past your ear.
Isn't there like burning sheet music at some point as well?
The show opens with burning sheet music.
Yeah.
No, she files sheet music. Yes. She burns economics textbooks.
Oh.
Which does feel less of a hate crime. Her,
her husband, who is the villain of the piece, was an economist. And there's a book called Capitalism and Freedom, which is where the title... Yeah.
So the piano is obviously a really massive central point between the relationship to two characters and a physical item on stage.
Yeah.
And as you have alluded, the second song we're listening to is called A Piano Is. Where does this fit into the piece?
Yeah. So the thing that we haven't told you about yet is that we have a cast member who will be on stage for the whole show who will be a concert pianist.
Yeah. Non-speaking role.
So all of the music that you will be heard, it will be classical and will be played by somebody who's live and amazing.
Oh my goodness.
Because classical music's so theatrical in its performance anyway. So it's like you can't put them in a, you know, in the scaff up the back and mic it all up and everything. Anyway, so, but this is the concert. So after Alice marries Edward, he signs her up for a concert, and it's Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto. Anybody who knows the repertoire will know that that's one of the hard ones, and it requires months and months and months of preparation. And within the label of concert pianist, there's degrees. You know, this is the hardest thing. Alice starts to find that her fingers are seizing up. She's getting RSI or something like that.
Carpal tunnel or anxiety induced.
Yeah. She can't move her fingers, but she tries to play through it, and that makes it worse. And her husband, of course, just says, go and do it anyway. You said you could do this. This is what you wanted. You said you could do this. Go and do it.
Don't embarrass me in front of my friends.
Exactly. So this song, A Piano Is... what you'll hear are the verses that are narrated by present day Alice as a sort of frame for the scenes that happen in the past of the concert and, preparing for the concert itself, it all going horribly wrong, and then the aftermath when it's all broken.
When you begin to play, you believe that a piano is an animal to be tamed, to be mastered, controlled, shown the way. You learn to listen, to hear the notes before they're played. A piano is an animal to be tamed, but a piano is a trap, a bait, a snare. It holds the promise of a life free of worry and care. You learn to hold on to that dream, but beware. A piano can be a trap to keep you, hold you there. A piano is an animal you can't tame. I walked on stage, the lights went down, the piano remained. The notes I heard were not the notes I played. That piano could have thrown me from the stage, but I stayed. To my shame, I stayed. When it was all over, I hid in the dressing room until everyone had gone.
So you've written this amazing material for the show, but this isn't all that you're working on.
No.
How do you find the time to do so many projects, and how does that work simultaneously?
I often find that I'm the most productive when I'm doing lots of things.
Actually,
it's so much harder to motivate yourself when you're just sitting at home doing nothing. Whereas like when there are lots of other things happening at the same time, you actually get more stuff done. Because there's a sense of urgency, and we go back to this like lack of editing, fail fast, all of those things, is that you just have the time crunch and you just have to do it, and it's better when you're busy.
And my philosophy is, you know, there's a lot of different roles you can have in theatre, and I decided that I only wanted one, and that was to write. And I decided that in my mid-20s or so. And of course it's stupid. I think with new musicals, you got to tee up as many shots as you can, because they're not all going to come off. You'd love them to, and hopefully they, you know, maybe they all will find their time at some point. But I have many, many, many projects going all at the same time, all in different stages of development. And
just give us a sense when you say many, many, many. What
10?
How are we? Okay,
yeah. But some of them are like, I've written a couple of songs with a collaborator, and we're waiting to hear whether we can continue it. So it's just one or two sort of seed commission stuff, or usually not a commission. So there's ideas floating around, but you know, there's usually something to do on each of them. At the minute, I'm very lucky. I'm about to embark on the most exciting, I guess, part of my career so far, which is nice.
Yeah.
Been a long time coming. So doing Unfortunate, which your listeners may know, it's going out for its sort of third incarnation, which is really exciting. We did it.
Amazing show. Love the show.
Oh, thanks.
So great.
It's a parody of The Little Mermaid starring Ursula. Don't bring your kids.
Don't bring your kids.
Is that the new tagline?
Yeah.
The merch range alone will scare the kids off.
Well, and of course, Unfortunate was on the podcast.
It was.
So if you scroll back through the archive,
that was a pre-pandemic.
Before times.
Yeah.
You
on
will
your
find
grand
a couple
piano,
of
that
brilliant
was,
songs.
Wasn't it?
I know, way Cops back played, when.
Of course. So that was when we did, you know, a version with Cast of Five and No Band at the Fringe in 2019. We're now doing it with a Cast of Ten and a three-piece band at Southwark Playhouse Elephant. Get your tickets now. And then I guess I'm doing a Southwark Playhouse residency as well, because I mentioned Grace and I met at Signal, this concert series. In 2018, I started developing Cable Street, which I've written with book writer Alex Konevsky, and we developed that through Signal, and then we've had a couple of workshops and things since. That is going into Southwark Playhouse Borough in February, so it's going to be a really, really busy time. If I'm honest, I probably won't have a lot of time for music and until the other side or anything else.
Is
any
this,
of the other
is this the time we're gonna talk
this
about
is when
it
we talk about
yeah
it.
Okay.
But we'll be putting dates in the diary, do you know what I mean, for afterwards.
Yeah.
And then, because you can't rest, can you? You can't be like, oh, and then after, because I think I did that after Stay Awake, Jake, in like 2016. I was like, well, this will go on and then I'll be famous or then I'll be successful or it'll go to Broadway or something. And it, you know, it doesn't happen like that, does it? You've got to try and tee up your projects so that you don't have a lull.
If you don't sow your seeds for projects while you're busy, then you definitely have very, very quiet periods.
Yeah.
And actually, Grace, I think you can give Tim a bit of a run for his money in terms of number of projects and other things you're working on too.
What, in this, in the studio at the other palace or just in?
Grace is going to become our resident director, writer.
Yes, I'm working on Becoming Nigella, which is written by Emily Rose Simons, produced by the incredible Tanya Truman. Know her name. She's amazing. And we are doing a little bit of work at the Manchester Jewish Museum and going to do some cooking on stage, which I'm very excited about. Yeah, I know. Oh,
that's very cool.
Yeah. And then I've got In Clay coming up. So that's written by Jack Miles and Rebecca Simmons. And I'm directing that. That'll be upstairs at the Gatehouse in March and April. So please come along and see it. A one-woman show about art and making art. And not getting famous for it.
And make sure you listen to that podcast episode because In Clay concludes this season.
Oh la la. Good. I loved him. And I'm co-producing and directing a revival version of the Australian musical The Hat Pin. My co-producer, Marianne Wright, and I are working with the writers to make a one-act version of the show with only women in it. Hopefully doing some workshopping here and in Melbourne.
Yeah.
So how do you think you're going to find time? I mean, I know you said let's put a pause, but up till now you've been balancing many different projects.
We've had pauses already. Do you know what I mean? When Grace goes off on tour and things with our directing hat on, you know, we know we can't do anything for a month or two. So, but what we do is we pop a date in the diary, like, hey, we need to do a musical for you. It's all it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just, you know, life in this phase of it is just horrible diary stuff. It's just like, when are you free? Oh, I'm not free this month or next month or the month. Okay, let's put a date in there.
and we're doing this, as Tim said, on spec. We're doing this under our own steam. So it should always feel good and fun. And so part of, you know, we go to Tim's place, we go for walks, we, you know, drink coffee, drink beer, and have a nice time while also doing the thing that we want to do.
Yeah.
We're otherwise, nice it all becomes time. Too stressful and too, and we don't want to do it. So it's great. We actually like hang out and stuff.
So, what's next for the project?
Yeah. So we've got, as I said, we've got our huge load of rewrites. Well, it's not that big, but we've got our load of rewrites to do on it, which we're really excited about. Just finessing. And bringing its life even further. But we don't have a producer. We don't have a venue. So I think the other thing that we need to be doing in tandem with this is sort of sending 100 emails, or perhaps some angel listening to this is going to email us and say, yes, please. That's what we need, really, is we probably need to expand the team. And the way that we do that is going to be some cold emailing. You never get away from that, do you? You always have to do a bit of that in life, and hopefully find the right partners to take it to the next stage.
Yeah,
we'd love a workshop,
always.
But with the way that we're doing, you know, hiring a seasoned actress and hiring a classical concert pianist, you can't just do it with your mates in the top room of a pub. You know, we've got to be able to finance it properly. And Grace and I can't do that privately.
No. We're basically looking for the right partners and the people who are interested in engaging the audiences that will really suit this piece.
Making a Musical is produced and hosted by Alex Jackson and Kiki Stevenson for The Other Palace.
If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe and rate the podcast wherever you're listening to help us share new British musical theatre with audiences all around the world.
You can submit your new musical to be featured on the podcast at theotherpalace.co.uk.
That's it from us. Join us next time for more
Making a musical,
the future of British musical theatre.